Nancy Grace Augusta Wake. 8 years earlier, the Pont Royal, Paris, 1936. The French are better at day drinking, likely because they've had more practice, but I'm determined to learn. It's a good thing Stephanie is already waiting for me at the Pont Royal. I can see her on the terrace at her usual table, arm draped over the ornate railing, a long-stemmed goblet held between two slim fingers. I rush across the street and into the bar, only to find it crowded with the usual clientele, packs of tweed-suited Gallimard. The Pont Royal is best known for catering to the editors who work at Edition Gallimard and journalists from all the daily papers. It's an excellent place to make connections and a better place to eavesdrop. Not yet 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and every single one of these men is halfway through a glass of cognac, ashtrays spilling over. They all sport the sloppy smiles of men who have knocked off work early to talk shop away from the office. I weave my way through the tables, pushing through clouds of cigar smoke, and out onto the terrace. There is an empty goblet on the table, along with the one in Stephanie's hand, and I marvel that she has already gone through a round of cocktails in the 30 minutes it's taken me to walk from my little flat on Rue Sainte Anne. Sorry I'm late. I drop into my chair and balance a large handbag on my lap. I look around the terrace, noting that for once she has not delivered on a promise. Where is he? I ask.
On his way.
Stephanie leans across the table to brush a light kiss against each of my cheeks. Born in Paris to Yugoslavian parents, she is both quintessentially French and curiously exotic. Although married to a Spaniard, she maintains her maiden name. This is a point of honor for her, a Rubicon that shall not be crossed, a stake driven so far in the ground that it can never be uprooted. Naturally, I take great joy in provoking her. Bonjour, Madame Gonzalez. Stephanie raises the goblet to her lips. It's filled with amber liquid, and a curl of sugared lemon peel dangles from the rim. She glares at me while taking a calculated sip, then spits out her maiden name along with a lemon seed. Marsic. Only then do I notice that she is drinking an earthquake, far and away her preferred cocktail, and a potent one at that. Clearly, I have catching up to do. The terrace is packed, and I crane my neck, searching for the waiter. It isn't until I wave him down that I notice half the men sitting around us are staring at Stephanie. No surprise there. She is undoubtedly beautiful, but in the Slavic way, with almond-shaped blue eyes the color of hydrangeas and wavy blonde hair. But it's her smile that she charms them with. Poor fools. She'll have them picking up our entire tab by the time we leave. I cannot believe you had this much liquor on an empty stomach, I say. Envious. I'm a two-pot screamer myself, helplessly sloshed after the second drink.
I was nervous.
I have known you for 3 years and never once have I seen you nervous about anything.
Not for myself.
She rolls her eyes.
For you. For the interview. It is important, no? And besides, you were late.
I nod meaningfully toward my handbag. I would have been here sooner, but I fell madly in love on the way over and decided that I had to have it at once. The purchase was very spontaneous, très parisien, and I am both shocked at myself and flush with excitement. Regardless, you're the only person I know who calms rattled nerves with an earthquake.
This drink is a balm to the soul, she says, running the pad of one finger along the curled lemon peel on the rim of her glass. That stupid English name doesn't do it justice. Say it in French, with proper pronunciation.
I wouldn't know a lick of French if not for Stephanie. Nor would I know how to wear a scarf, smoke a gitane, drink cognac, or wear red lipstick. She is my tutor in the pursuit of becoming a Parisienne, and I am her devoted student. Fine. Tremblement de terre. I can hear the slight twang in my voice, the Australian accent I've worked so hard to hide. But it's passable. A stranger on the street will understand what I've said.
Much better, ma petite.
Stephanie claps her hands as though I'm a child in need of encouragement.
You are coming along nicely. I'm learning the key is not to bother with all those bloody feminine and masculine rules of yours, all the lure this and la that. It just gives me the shits. I wait patiently for her to laugh or reply, but she is transfixed by something on my lap.
Nancy, she says, why is your handbag moving on its own?
Oh,
please tell me that is not a dog,
she says, as I lift the tiny wire-haired terrier from my purse. His ears are pointed, his hair is white, his eyes are black, and his tongue is pink. He bears a startling resemblance to a cartoon, or a coin purse. His name is Picon, I say, setting one hand to my heart, and I believe he will be the great love of my life. The little dog licks my wrist as though to confirm the sentiment. Stephanie is aghast.
Why was he in your purse?
Because he wouldn't fit in my pocket.
What I mean to say is, why have you brought him with you?
Well, he's hungry, for one thing, and I couldn't very well leave him at home. Besides, I only bought him half an hour ago. I lift the ball of puffy white hair, hardly bigger than my hand, and nuzzle him into the crook of my neck. I had the strangest sensation while crossing over the Rue de Rivoli a little while ago, as though someone was watching me. I turned, and there he was, in the window of that little shop between the cobbler and the chocolatier, you know, where the street dips down and the puddles collect after every rain. It was love at first sight.
He feels it too. I can see it in his eyes.
Put it down. It's going to piss on you. Picon would never.
Picon, Stephanie says,
as in the aperitif?
Exactly so. And one day I will get him a wife and I will name her Grenadine and they will live happily all of their days. Stephanie presses her lips together, trying not to laugh, so I do it for her. My laughter has always been sudden and combustible and loud. She shakes her head at the sound. Stephanie takes my laugh quite personally, as though I invented it to threaten her own staggering appeal. Yes, she's married, to a man we call Count Gonzales, though none of us actually know his first name. But it only makes her more attractive somehow. Unattainable. Men hardly look at me when she's in the room, so I won't apologize for any advantage I can get.
What? It's not fair, you know, that laugh of yours. I'd give anything for it. And see, it's already earned you an admirer.
She motions behind me with a tilt of her chin, and there's a brief flash of something in her eyes. Mischief or jealousy, perhaps. But it's gone before I can identify it. At first, I think she means one of those ridiculous, uptight gallimards, so I turn to stare him down. But instead of an angry editor, I find a handsome man with a crooked smile. He's sitting at the far end of the terrace, at a table by himself, wine glass in hand, and he is staring at me.
Oh, good grief, don't look! Have I taught you nothing?
But it's too late. This curious man has seen me. So I tip my head to the side, brazenly meeting his gaze.
That is Henri Fiocca, Stephanie says, the most notorious heartbreaker in all of France.
Not just Paris, but all of France? That's quite an accomplishment. I laugh again louder, and his eyes tighten with curiosity. He's too pretty to be a journalist, I say, turning back to Stephanie.
He's not.
What then? A model, an actor, minor royalty like your husband?
He's an industrialist.
I scratch Picon between the ears. Which could mean anything from canned goods to the opium trade.
He's in shipbuilding.
Sounds boring.
I think the word you're looking for is lucrative.
And you know this how?
He does business with the Count. And I hear stories.
This is how she always refers to her husband. The Count, never by his actual name. With pride, yes, but never intimacy.
Mr. Fiocca is very beautiful.
Oui, but he is trouble.
In all the time I've known Stephanie, she has never warned me off a man, and I find this quite suspicious. I'm about to ask what she means when the waiter finally arrives at our table.
Qu'est-ce que je peux vous servir?
It takes a moment, but I answer in somewhat broken French. Vin rouge et une, planche de charcuterie. I give Stephanie a questioning glance to make sure I've gotten my order correct. She nods, pleased with her tutelage.
Anything else?
The waiter asks, in English now to accommodate my broken French. He grins at Stephanie.
Madame?
A friend will be joining us soon, Stephanie says, motioning to the empty seat beside her.
You will have a glass of Chateau Barthé Rosé.
She smiles at the waiter, and I fear he will drop to one knee and propose on the spot. The poor man stumbles away in a daze. How did you find him? I ask. Every journalist in the city has been looking for him since Milo ran that picture. Hell, how did you even learn his name? 2 weeks ago, my editor at Hearst published a photograph of an unknown man on his knees, face turned to the sky, bleeding onto the cobblestones of Vienna's old square. The headline screamed, "Terror in Vienna," and every journalist in the city has been scrambling for an exclusive ever since. Stephanie claims to have acquired it for me. She shrugs.
The Count has connections.
It answers nothing, and I am about to press her, but damn him, our waiter is back in record time, stepping between us. He holds a tray in one hand and makes a show of arranging everything on the table before offering a small bow and disappearing. The delicate scent of fresh bread, fine cheese, and cured meat wafts up from the table. This is a thing I have found that is present only in France. The food smells different here. It is pervasive, and it makes me wonder if I've ever truly smelled my food before. Little Picon, who has been still and quiet in the crook of my arm, begins to squirm and whine, so I pluck a small piece of shaved ham from the platter and feed it to him with my fingers. Stephanie grimaces. This is the one area in which she defers to her Yugoslavian heritage. The woman cannot stand the French habit of taking pets in public.
That is disgusting, she says.
He's hungry.
Then put it down and let it eat off the floor, like a proper dog.
I open my mouth to protest, but a champagne glass magically appears on the table in front of me. What is this? A different waiter stands beside me dutifully.
Le 75, he says, courtesy of that gentleman in the corner.
The French 75. It is the Pont Royal's signature cocktail and the most expensive item on their drinks menu. I have always wanted to try one. Clever man. This drink is an invitation, and an elegant one at that. Much as I sensed Picon this afternoon, I can feel Henri Fioca staring at me. I lift the champagne glass and turn to consider him again. I take a sip. My mouth is instantly awash in the bright notes of gin, lemon, and champagne. Expensive. Top shelf. Henri Fioca is showing off. The bubbles tickle my nose, and I cannot help but smile.
Tell me about him, I say to Stephanie, without taking my eyes off this graceful stranger.
She obliges.
Français, obviously. A good bit older than you, I think. Don't let that alarm you. The best ones are always older. Comes from a wealthy family from Marseille. Notorious with the women.
She recites this curriculum vitae even as I take another appreciative sip. He has dark curly hair, brown eyes, a square jaw, and the sort of cheekbones that could make a girl weep with envy. Broad shoulders. He's sitting down, so I can't tell for sure. But I suspect he's quite tall. Taller than me, at least, and this definitely works in his favour. I absolutely hate having to wear flats just because a man didn't have the good sense to grow a few inches taller. Fioca stares back, waiting, hopeful, patient. And this surprises me, because at first glance I would have taken him for the sort of man who likes to pounce. But no, he's letting me decide. And I am so very tempted. One more sip, and I close my eyes to relish the swirling citrus fizz on my tongue. I am about to stand and make my way to Fjocka's table when Stephanie demands my attention.
Nancy,
she says, and there is a note of urgency in her voice that has me turning back to her. What? She's staring at the door that leads onto the terrace, and,
ha, there's no mistaking the man who stands there.
The Count has convinced him to come after all. What part Stephanie herself played is still unclear. She could have convinced or seduced, blackmailed or charmed, for all I know. There's no telling with this ridiculous, miracle-working woman.
He's here,
she breathes, as though she can't quite believe it herself. Janosch Liebermann certainly knows how to make an entrance. Or perhaps it is that he himself is so striking he commands attention. Janosch doesn't have a unique face, per se. He's pleasant-looking, but not remarkable. Dark hair, dark eyes, dark stubble across his solemn face. It's the jagged pink scar cutting its way from earlobe to eyeball that makes him instantly recognizable. The whip split him clean to the bone and nearly took out his left eye in the process. Even from this distance, the stitch marks are still evident, little pocked craters at even intervals along his cheekbone. The scar looks like a broken zipper, and he will forever be marked by its ferocity. You cannot help but stare when you see him. Stephanie is on her feet, halfway to the door before I can collect my wits. And then she's greeting him, kissing both cheeks, and leading him back to the table before the Gallimard can pounce. This is the man I have come to meet, not Henri Fjocka, appealing as he may be. So I turn back to the Frenchman and tip up my glass, downing the rest of this glorious French 75 in three luxurious gulps. I give him a polite nod of gratitude and dismissal. Henri Fjocka raises an eyebrow, then offers a sigh of disappointment. His shoulders drop, and I find this both amusing and sad. Such a pity. I turn back to the table, where Stephanie and our guest now stand before me. This is important. I give them my full attention.
Nancy,
she says, practically quivering with excitement.
Meet Janosch Liebermann.
He extends his hand and I receive it gladly. It's an enormous hand, dry and calloused and oddly cool despite the warm afternoon.
Thank you for coming, I say.
Janosch takes his seat but says nothing.
Don't worry, I warned him about you.
Stephanie gives me that smile, the one that could be an apology or a declaration of war. Then she hands him the glass of rosé.
Here, I took the liberty of ordering you some wine.
It's an interesting choice of drink for a man, but not without calculation on Stephanie's part. Men are particular about their liquor, and most people have a strong preference between red or white wine. Rosé, in late afternoon, is the easiest, safest thing to order for a total stranger. He takes it without question.
Thank you.
Stephanie situates herself between the Gallimard and our guest. She's trying to block their view, to prevent them from studying his scar, but half the men on this terrace have recognized him already. There is a buzz in the air. They know he isn't just one of the countless Austrians who have spilled across the border into France this year, but rather the face of Vienna's persecution epidemic. Hearst insists that in my articles I refer to men like Janosch as political refugees, but the truth is they are Jews, running scared. This one in particular. He's got that hunted look in his eyes. Clothes wrinkled from wear, cuticles picked raw. He needs a shave. Hell, he needs a friend. It was Janosch who insisted we meet in a public place, after all, and I can't say that I blame him. But I can tell by the way his hands are shaking that he is afraid to talk. The Gallimard know it too. Some are wide-eyed with interest, others show thinly veiled disgust or horror. Many try to hide their animosity behind pursed lips and lit cigars. It's no wonder. Janosch has chosen to share his story with me. And they have reason to envy that fact.
They recognize me from that damn photograph,
Janosch says, his Austrian accent heavy, as he glances around the terrace. He sets a hand self-consciously against his left cheek. I expect him to wince at the touch, but but he doesn't. Janosz lifts his glass from the table, and I watch his Adam's apple bob up and down as he takes a sip of the wine. It makes him look vulnerable, exposed, like a teenage boy trying to be braver than he is. After a moment, he shakes his head.
This was a mistake. I shouldn't have come.
And just like that, I can feel my story slipping away. I do the first thing that comes to mind. Look at me, I tell him. He does. I set the pad of my index finger against his scar. My touch is curious, not seductive, like a doctor examining a wound, and I hold his gaze the entire time. Who did this to you?
The brown shirts.
And who took that photograph?
Janosz shudders, as though the piece inside him that holds everything together has broken loose.
It doesn't matter. He's dead now.
Instinctively, I lean toward this opening that he has created. Here is my story, and I am determined to catch it as it falls from his lips. I can see him filling his lungs, gathering courage, and I do not turn away, not as he braces himself, not even when one of the Gallimard makes a crude remark behind me.
Please, I say, tell me what happened in Vienna.
Henri. Damn. He likes the way she laughs. He likes the rest as well, but it's her laugh that has him standing with one foot in the street and one foot on the curb, staring at the terrace where she sits with her friends. No one could blame him for waiting an hour longer, hoping she would change her mind and accept his company after all. Henri waited until he felt like a fool, and then he decided to leave. But now, she's at it again. Head tilted back, eyes squeezed shut, palm flat against her heart, that little dog in her lap, laughing as though she has an endless supply, as though laughter is a thing that can be wasted, scattered wantonly in the street. It fills the air, rich and lusty, and he'd go back in and buy her another drink if he thought it would do any good. But no, he offered, and she declined. He likes to think she was a bit sad about it, however. Perhaps he flatters himself. Still, Henri hesitates, and she must sense it, because that beguiling woman turns and finds him lingering here at the corner. He nods once, embarrassed. She smiles again, and in the moment before she turns back to her friends, those pale, mischievous eyes tighten at the corners, and he sees something flash in them. Curiosity. But a blink is all it takes to break the connection, and just like that, his opportunity is lost. She looks away, and he leaves for good. Damn.
Vienna, St. Stephen's Square. What are we looking for? Frank Gilmore asks as we make our way through a tangle of vehicles that have stopped outside Vienna's famed St. Stephen's Square. I look up toward the great Gothic towers of the Stephansdom, and I push forward, intent. Janosz said it happened near this cathedral, the very place where Mozart and many of the Habsburgs were married. Such a violent act for a holy place. A man with a whip, I say over my shoulder. His legs are longer than mine, and he catches up quickly.
Nancy, are you sure? It was a long train ride, Frank. If you wanted to back out, you should have done it 12 hours ago.
I missed the chance for a romantic getaway with Nancy Wake? Never.
I snort. This isn't a date.
It could be.
There's laughter in Frank's eyes when he winks at me.
I'm an equal opportunity romantic.
I believe the word you're looking for is incorrigible. Long-limbed, freckled, toothy, hair the color of old potatoes, Frank Gilmore is a caricature of himself. The combination of his physical attributes makes you think he should have been a redhead but swam the wrong direction in the gene pool. I've always suspected he's a bit disappointed about this. I think he would have worn that ginger badge with honor. Regardless, Frank is one of the best photographers in Paris. I brought him because he's fearless. Rumor has it he once hung upside down from the girders of the Pont de Passy just to get a picture of King George as he sailed beneath on his royal yacht, the Britannia. Turns out, George was napping under a canopy, and all you could see in the photo were his swollen feet. It was never published, but Frank became a legend. The print now hangs above the toilet in his flat. Frank says it makes him laugh every time he uses the loo. It's one of the many reasons I find him endearing. Like me, Frank is a freelancer. And if I've learned anything since bluffing my way onto the roster at Hearst, it's that we carrion birds of the publishing world must flock together. He didn't hesitate when I called him yesterday and proposed this adventure. After a few minutes of weaving our way through traffic and onlookers, Frank and I make it to Vienna's old square. There's a huge crowd of people standing in a circle before the Stephansdom, and somewhere in the middle of it, a woman is screaming. I look at Frank and he nods. He lifts the camera from where it hangs on a strap around his neck and slips into the crowd on my right. I am average height and average weight, but still it takes me a long time to push my way through the wall of bodies to see what's going on. I'm not the sort of woman you'd call angular, but I do have sharp elbows, and I put them to good use as I maneuver my way into the open. I am struck by three things at once. The bonfire, the brown shirts, and the water wheel. The fire burns right in the middle of the square, 50 feet from the cathedral steps, filling the air with rancid smoke and turning the ancient cobblestones black. Around it saunter 7 brown shirts holding rifles. 2 more brown shirts heap contents from one of the nearby shops onto the fire. They are the Sturmabteilung, Hitler's private military, the men he brought with him to power, the men who answer to him alone. And here they are, just as Janosch said, tormenting Vienna's Jewish shopkeepers. No, not tormenting. Torturing. An old woman is tied spread-eagle to the massive water wheel. It rattles and clanks through the square in a large undulating circle, pushed along on each side by a brown shirt. They turn her round and round as she cries and screams. Her long salt and pepper braids swish back and forth across her shoulders as her shawl drags on the ground beside her. I am ashamed to admit that I had not believed Janosch, not truly. His story seemed so outrageous, so unbelievable 2 nights ago at the Pont Royal. He must have known how hard it would be for someone like me to truly understand. And I think he must have pitied my ignorance as we sat there warm and fed and content. To me, this was a story to pursue. But to Janosch, it was a nightmare to escape. "Go to Vienna's old square on a Friday afternoon," he said. "They like to begin their spectacles a few hours before Shabbat begins. It gets worse every week." Finally, the water wheel rolls to a stop, and I am frozen, immobile, as a brown shirt steps forward. He looks like the sort of man who was laughed at as a child, teased mercilessly, as though he's been assembled with spare parts and put together in haste. Large head on narrow shoulders, sparse hair combed away from a high forehead, eyebrows so thick and black it looks as though they've been drawn in charcoal by a child's clumsy hand. Lipless mouth, sunken eyes with dark circles beneath, huge ears with long lobes that slide right into the sides of his neck. The rest of him is hidden beneath that brown uniform and those tall brown boots, so I cannot guess at his height or strength. But in his hand there is a whip, and I know that this is the man I have come to find. He walks toward the water wheel and the woman tied to it. I expect there to be some speech, some bit of pomp and circumstance, a warning at least. But no, he simply attacks. I hear the whip before I see the strike. There is a single crack like the sound of breaking rock, and then a red stripe opens across the old woman's back, splitting her dress diagonally, splitting the air with her screams. The man has found his rhythm now, and he strikes again, then again, and again. Crack, 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 4 red lashes across her back.
There is a rushing in my ears and a rising in my stomach. I don't know what to do. I stand in silent, horrified witness along with every other person in the square. Two brown shirts still hold the wheel upright, but the others pace in front of the crowd, rifles up and ready, waiting, hoping someone will intervene. They are eager for an opportunity to shoot. The man with the whip begins to shout, cracking the air with emphasis.
Juden verboten! Juden verboten! Juden verboten!
Jews forbidden. Jews forbidden. Jews forbidden. There's a sharp intake of breath beside me, but I do not turn to look. I force myself to be still, to listen instead. And I hear the truth. Most of the shopkeepers in this square are Jewish. They will all be driven out, or worse. They are not welcome. This fact is written across the square in red paint, now that I have the eyes to see it, now that I look beyond that wheel. Over half the shop windows are dripping with red paint, Juden daubed on them in a sloppy, hateful scrawl. The two soldiers beside the wheel make one last half rotation, leaving the woman upside down, panting heavily, body stiff, braced for another blow. Her dress has fallen down around her waist, and her bunched, torn undergarments are on display before the crowd. It is not enough that they have wounded her. They intend to shame her as well. We can all see the pale skin of her thighs, the trembling of her muscles, and the blue corded veins that are knotted in bunches at the back of her knees.
Juden verboten,
the man says, loudly, clearly one last time. Who is that? I ask the shopkeeper beside me, not taking my eyes from the brown shirt in charge. I pray this stranger speaks enough English to understand me, and I make a mental note to brush up on basic German.
Obersturmführer Wolf.
Obersturmführer? The Germanic languages are a mystery to me, all hard edges and rough grunts. I don't know what this word means. He spits onto the cobblestones.
Nazi.
Oh. Oh. Slowly, carefully, I pull my notepad and pen from my skirt pocket and begin writing. It's the only thing I can do. I write because I am afraid I will forget the specifics, remembering only the horror. I write details. Brown shirts, whips, water wheels. I write about red paint and red welts. I write names and ranks the best I can remember and spell them. I write without ever looking at my notepad because that is too conspicuous. I let my hand travel messily across the page, searching for Frank, praying he has captured this on film. I scan each face, looking for his close-cropped potato head. The square is now still. And that's what reveals Frank in the end. But not just to me. The man they call Wolf hears the shutter of Frank's camera at the same moment I do. It's an unmistakable sound in this deathly quiet air. Frank, trying to get one last photo. Chunk. Click. It is a sound of proof being exposed, and Wolf's large round head follows the telltale noise to the doorway of an empty storefront where Frank has taken refuge. He is squatting on the threshold to get a better angle, his entire body leaning forward. He is the last person to realize that Wolf has seen him, and all I can think about is how Janosch said the man who took his picture is dead. Frank's name is rising in my chest, hurtling toward my lips, when he finally lowers the camera. He scrambles to his feet, lips moving frantically as though running through his options. Fight, flight, faint. Wolf drops his hand to his side and unfurls the whip. He lets it drag behind him on the ground like the tail of a rat as he walks toward Frank. I might not be romantically interested in him, but I've never respected Frank more than I do in this moment, because he does not flinch, does not run or make a fist or lose his nerve. He grips the camera in two hands and holds it tight against his chest like a shield, back straight, jaw clenched, lip curled in defiance. Frank waits. I can almost see him counting off Wolf's footsteps in the seconds it takes for them to come face to face. No words are exchanged, no threats, no violence. Wolf simply looks Frank up and down, notes the pale shade of his skin and the freckles strewn about his face like ink on parchment. And Wolf makes a decision about the worth of this one man's life. The scales weigh in Frank's favour, apparently, because Wolf reaches out with his free hand and grabs the camera. Frank grips it tighter, his knuckles turning white as he strains to hold on. No. His entire body screams the word, resisting. Wolf raises the whip. And I see it there in Frank's eyes, the calculation. He cannot retain his grip on the camera and block the whip at the same time. He must choose. Wolf yanks again, and the camera is ripped out of Frank's hands. It's like an appendage being rent from his body, a violent separation. A serpentine invasion of the soul. Hatred. Pure and holy hatred. That's what I feel as I watch Wolf turn from Frank without ever speaking a word and strut toward the bonfire, those tall brown boots clipping against the uneven stones of the Stephansplatz. He lifts the camera and turns before the crowd as though displaying a piece of evidence before a jury. He shows it slowly to every pair of watching eyes. And then he hurls it to the ground with all his strength. Frank's camera shatters on contact and fills the square with the sound of cracking metal and breaking glass. Wolf bends down and pulls the long ribbon of film from its compartment, exposing it to the light. He tosses the film onto the fire, where it curls in on itself like burnt hair, then kicks each remaining piece into the coals.
Nine cameras! Wolf shouts.
One long, spindly finger pointing at the bonfire. I'm so busy watching the camera burn, breathless, that I don't even notice one of the brown shirts approach me. I don't pay any attention as he reaches out and yanks the notepad from my hands. One moment it's there, and the next I'm left with three long paper cuts against the index finger of my left hand. I feel the sting first, and the rage second. Frank, however, has seen this, and he has forgotten his camera, his outrage, and is rushing toward me. He knows me well. And it's a good thing, too, because I'm filling my lungs, I'm stepping forward, I'm reaching for the notebook. And then I am engulfed entirely in the wiry arms of Frank Gilmore. He looks to be all tendon and bone, but Frank is built like a steel cable. Once wrapped around me, he is immovable. Don't! He hisses in my ear. It's not worth the whip. I struggle against the surprising strength of his grasp. I want my notebook. I want revenge. But Frank is right. Wolf will not spare me simply because I'm a woman. Today's demonstration is proof of that. Frank's voice drops to a whisper, barely audible in my left ear. You never forget a damn thing, Nancy, he says. Write your article anyway. We stand there as our belongings and the contents of the old woman's millinery shop are consumed by fire, the air thick with the smell of burning wool and silk. One beautiful hat after another is tossed into the flames, first turning black around the edges, then collapsing inward only to combust with defeated little puffs, as though silenced by outrage. We watch as Wolf and his brown shirts saunter from the square. We watch as the crowd waits, antsy, for them to climb onto their motorcycles. Every ear is tuned to the rumble of engines and the squeal of tires as they speed away, victorious. Then three men rush forward and lower the water wheel to the ground. They murmur soothing things to the old woman. They gently cover her exposed body. We watch them cut the ropes that bind her wrists and ankles from the wheel and carry her off, limp and whimpering.
Your camera.
It's all I can think to say, the only words I can summon.
Can be replaced.
I feel Frank shrug around me.
But the photos.
He clears his throat, but doesn't answer. So Frank Gilmore isn't as stoic as he'd like to appear, then. My voice is that of a stranger, distant, tremulous, weak.
What just happened? I wouldn't treat an animal that way, much less a human.
That's because you are human, Nancy. They are not. Or at least not anymore. The crowd begins to disperse, whispering and wringing their hands. But still Frank holds on to me. So I drop into a squat and slip out of his arms. Enough of that. I stand there, hands on my hips, glaring after the motorcycles. I can hear the alarm in his voice when he asks, "What are you thinking? If this is happening in Vienna, what's it like in Berlin?" Berlin. The Brandenburg Gate. We follow the sound of chanting. To his credit, Frank didn't abandon me at the Westbahnhof train station in Vienna. He could have. His camera is destroyed, and without photos, there's no chance of him getting paid. He has no reason to wade further into this mess. But God bless him, Frank is British, and therefore a gentleman. He refused to send me into the lion's den alone. It is 8 hours by train from Vienna to Berlin, but only 1 mile from the station to the Brandenburg Gate, so we make the trip on foot. I'm glad for the exercise, for the chance to stretch my legs. I've spent 20 of the last 36 hours on a train, with Frank no less. He snores, and I'd give my kingdom for a warm bath and a soft bed. I miss my pillow. I miss Picon. Poor baby is staying with Stephanie and must think I've abandoned him. But there is work to be done, and all those things can wait.
Dare I ask what we're looking for this time?
Frank is far less enthusiastic now. He hasn't mentioned romance since Vienna.
And will there be a whip?
I don't know, I say, answering both questions at once. Wolf is a brown shirt. He came from here. His entire world view originated here. And I cannot report on what's happening without seeing it firsthand. Frank might not have a camera anymore, but he can stand as witness. And as we melt into the crowd, I am grateful for his presence. It is an odd thing to be amidst a sea of people and not understand a word they speak. I have been on my own since I was 16, for 8 years now, travelling and living abroad, first in New York, then London, and now Paris. But the only language I've ever tried to learn is French. It feels right to me. I like the way each word rolls off my tongue. It is light and artful, like toile, like champagne. German is something else entirely. It originates in the throat. It's a rumble and threat. Guttural and deep, and it sounds ominous as we are swept along in this mass of bodies headed toward the beating heart of Berlin. Frank keeps trying to hold my hand, protectively, I think, and I swat it away. I'm not afraid, I say, as a way to soften the sting.
You should be. I am.
He moves his grip to my elbow and I feel the drag as he begins to slow down. I can feel his hesitation with every step. He wants to turn back. But I lean forward, jaw stiff. Then that's how we differ, because I am angry. He shakes his head.
You are a terrifying woman, Nancy Wake.
I laugh because I don't think of myself as terrifying at all, but I'm glad he does. Frank, however, doesn't find any of this funny.
That doesn't mean you have to be reckless, he says. We don't even know what's going on here.
And running away won't tell us.
He gnaws at the inside of his bottom lip.
What you call running away, I call escaping, he mutters.
He lets me lead him forward through the crowd, but he never releases my elbow. There are at least 3 dozen risers set up around the Brandenburg Gate. They circle the great swath of open area in front of the monument, and the crowd spills into the space, most people rushing forward to be at ground level before a large wooden podium that squats before the gate. Over there, I say, urging Frank toward the nearest riser on the left. Once seated, we are about 25 yards from the podium, close enough to see clearly, but not to be noticed in return.
What now?
He asks as we settle onto the hard wooden seats. We wait. We see what happens. As it turns out, We wait for a very, very long time. Through lunch, through the afternoon, hungry, tired, thirsty. We watch the area fill with more living bodies than one would think possible. We watch the flags unfurl, the uniforms arrive, and the orchestra assemble. We watch, and in our exhausted state we try to remember, to file everything away as best we can. I know I won't recall the details on my own, so I make a game out of it. "Test me," I say, closing my eyes and turning my face to the sky. The sun is warm on my cheeks and my hair. I can feel a tingling at my scalp as my dark strands soak up the heat. "On what?" Frank whispers. "Everything. I need to remember this, and I don't dare bring attention to us by writing it down." It's a diversion from the boredom, so he decides to play along.
"Okay, all right, the gate. How many columns?"
12. 6 on each side. Together, they form 5 passageways through the gate.
"And what sits on top of the columns?"
"A massive stone cap."
It's not the answer he's looking for because he adds, "And on top of that?"
I think for a moment, hunting for that detail. I've spent hours staring at the gate already. It should be easy to recall. But instead, I have to reach into the white spaces of my mind. This is why the game is so important. Memory is tricky, easily bleached by hunger and exhaustion. After several moments of groping around, I see it once more. "A bronze sculpture," I say.
"Of?"
"A chariot drawn by 4 horses." Perhaps Frank finds the game calming as well, because his voice sounds less tense when he asks,
"The open area in front of the gate is surrounded by what?"
"A colonnade. It's very Romanesque, a place where Caesar would have pontificated." He snorts.
"Be careful what you ask for. The world doesn't need another Caesar."
"Tell that to the Germans." Frank doesn't like this line of thought, apparently.
"Keep going."
"On the other side of the gate is a boulevard that leads straight to the city palace. It's lined on both sides by linden trees. They're all full and puffy and the leaves haven't started to turn yet."
We go on like this for some time, and I sit there all the while, eyes closed, answering his questions about crowd size, well over 5,000 at this point, orchestra size, full, though there is one trumpeter who must have been recently drafted because he cannot play a note, they should have given the poor man a set of bells. Weather, bright and sunny but not enough wind. Smells, sweat, shoe polish, grilled sausage and sauerkraut from the food carts, and something else, something tinny and metallic and very human. Excitement, perhaps, or maybe fear. And sounds. Chanting, cheering and chatter, the revving of engines in the distance, honks and squeaks from the orchestra warming up, singing, whispers, tired children crying somewhere behind us. And now, finally, the swell of anticipation, a kind of static electricity in the air. Our presence here is accidental. We had no way of knowing there would be a rally. But it is illuminating. Hitler's entrance is specifically designed and timed perfectly. Frank and I literally have a front row seat to this madness. Hitler waits until we are half delirious from heat and hunger and exhaustion, until we have sat through hours of political theatre and endless martial songs, ranks of goose-stepping soldiers. He waits until our ears are throbbing from the triumphant notes of the orchestra playing Wagnerian overtures, drums, marching, chanting, our bodies slipping into a trance of sensory overload. Hitler waits until the blue hour, that moment when the sun is down but the sky has not yet turned dark. No moon, no stars. The 12 enormous marble columns of the gate are illuminated with floodlights, while the sky behind it turns a royal, majestic blue. Some might even call it divine. It's all part of the theatrics, of course, designed to make him look bigger and more powerful than he really is. It is designed to make him look invincible, godlike. And I'm sure he does look like that to this waiting, eager, throbbing mass of humanity. because they lose their collective mind when he steps onto the podium, arms raised, anticipating their worship.
"What the flaming hell is that?"
Frank whispers in my ear as a tattered, stained flag is raised above the podium.
"Oh," I say, "that explains why he's holding the rally here."
He just looks at me, waiting for an explanation.
3 years ago, Hitler led a torch-lit procession through this gate when he seized power.
Okay, but what is that?
He points again at the tattered, stained flag.
The first words Hitler speaks are shouted into the microphone with psychotic zeal.
The Blutfahne!
The blood banner. It takes me a moment to realize I've not said the words aloud, so I speak them in disbelief. I thought it was a myth, some sort of exaggeration promulgated by Hitler to advance his own grandiosity. To witness it with my own eyes feels like witnessing a prophesied abomination, something warned of in the Bible.
It looks like a piss-poor flag, he says.
It is, but it's the first one he commissioned. We are witnessing one of Hitler's most venerated rituals, the solemn consecration of the colors.
Frank leans close to my ear, afraid of being overheard. Why are they touching the other flags to it? One by one, uniformed soldiers step forward and extend flags attached to long wooden poles and brush them against the blood banner that waves ominously above Hitler's head.
Those are swastikas. Each new flag is touched to the blood banner in blessing. That first flag is said to be steeped in the blood of those who died during Hitler's first failed coup over a decade ago. They say that 15 of his supporters were killed that night, and he soaked the flag in their blood as a tribute to their loyalty.
That's disgusting.
No, it's evil. But look at them. They don't care.
The crowd is cheering, reverential. All eyes on him. Everyone on the balls of their feet, palms raised in salute.
How do you know all of this?
I interviewed Hitler once.
Frank looks at me, stupefied, as though I've just admitted to a candle-lit dinner with Lucifer himself.
You did what?
It was one of my first assignments for Hearst, 3.5 years ago. They sent me to Vienna to interview the new German Chancellor. I'd only heard the name Adolf Hitler once or twice at that point. I had no idea what he would become.
I want to hear that story if we make it out of here.
I shrug, ashamed to admit that I underestimated the impact he would have on the world. At the time, he was just an assignment, a crazy man pontificating in Germany. Because I was female and unknown, Hitler allotted only 30 minutes for the interview. The entire thing took place in a barber shop while he was being shaved with a straight razor. I still remember the scrape of that blade against his neck, the way it slid over the tender skin of his throat, and the snip of the scissors as his mustache was trimmed. The barber lifted the razor every time the Chancellor answered one of my questions, so as not to nick him. Once, I thought I saw his hand tremble. I made eye contact with Hitler only twice. When I introduced myself, and when he dismissed me, he did not thank me or say goodbye. It all seems like a lifetime ago. I've been living wild and free ever since, traveling Europe, having my fun. I've been blind and deaf to most of what's been happening around me. Then I met Janosch Liebermann. He was in Vienna, surrounded by this growing cancer the entire time, and I wouldn't know half of what Adolf Hitler has done since that interview if not for him.
Sieg Heil, the crowd begins to chant in unison. Jawohl,
he screams in reply, that rasping staccato voice echoing through the air.
Berlin!
This is how people are brainwashed, I think. This is how they follow a monster. Everyone around me is mesmerized. Their eyes glazed over, their breathing slow and rhythmic. And the longer he speaks, the more the crowd is hypnotized. They lean into his words, consuming them. Hitler shouts, they nod, His Lilliputian mustache quivers, his fists punch the air, he jabs and gesticulates, and they devour every word. They love him. They worship him. He is flanked by brown shirts, each of them as putridly self-satisfied as Wolf, and I scan their faces for that whip-wielding monster, but am relieved to find him absent. "Sieg Heil!" they scream, frantic, obsessed, saluting and clapping, believing every word, receiving every command they've just been given. Men, women, children, all of them swallowing it whole so they can be corroded from the inside out. Frank reaches for my hand again, and his voice is trembling when he says, "Can we go now? What more do you want to see?" "Nothing," I say, and we slip off the risers, invisible to everyone around us, for their eyes are on Hitler alone. I want to see nothing else.